Good evening, and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. It's graduation time again across the country, with colleges and universities holding their commencement exercises, including Boston University earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work, specifically stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story based on the theme, The Value of Higher Education. As you might expect, the topics varied widely. We begin with this report from Chris Aliano, looking at how some students are trying to cope with student debt.
It's the statement that says how much you borrow.
Students shuffle into a lecture hall, take their seats, open their notebooks or laptops, and set their attention to the man at the front of the School of Law auditorium. But this lecture is a bit different from the others given here. This is a Federal Perkins Loan Exit Counseling Group interview, and we're surrounded by countless graduating seniors. In a little more than 6 months, most of them have to begin a series of debt repayments over the course of at least the next few years.
They're going to tell you how much you borrow. That's the amount that was credited to your student account.
With the cost of higher level education soaring in recent years, students all over are bound by loans that will keep them in the red for many years to come. One of them is Laurel Bennis, a junior in the BU School of Management.
I'm about $120,000 in debt right now. I look back and I probably could have gone to other schools that maybe would have had a similar reputation, but I know in the Boston area it pays off being a business student at BU. A lot of companies that I will be hiring know the program that we go through, and a lot of business schools don't have the programs and the classes that we have at the undergraduate level.
Think about that. $120,000. That's a lot more than I'll be making for quite some time. I asked her how I got to this point.
I never thought it'd be this bad. I mean, BU's been okay with giving me financial aid, but still, when loans add up very quickly, it's been more of a process than I thought, just applying for loans and going through BU. They haven't exactly been the most helpful. They kind of set a budget that you're allowed to take out each year, and they don't care whether you don't have the money past the budget to cover expenses.
In 2008, two-thirds of bachelor's degree recipients graduated with debt. It was less than half that in 1993. Pell Grants for low-income students are expected to be cut, and tuition at public universities will likely increase as states with pinch budgets cut back on the money they give to colleges.
It gets most stressful when it comes time at the beginning of the semester and it comes time for me having to pay that first round of rent and I don't have the money on time when I need it. That's probably the most stressful, is just needing the money and not always having it.
But at the same time, a report issued by College Board last fall says that median earnings of bachelor's degree recipients are about $22,000 more than the median earnings of high school graduates. And the unemployment rate is lower as well. Despite situations like Bennis's, where there seems to be no end in sight to rising debt, many financial experts say college is still the smart investment and will pay off. Vincent Simonelli is the director of collections and student loans at BU and the leader of today's seminar.
Even in a bad economy, statistically speaking, people with a four-year degree, even people with a two-year degree, stand a much better chance of getting a job, holding a job, and getting a job that pays their expenses. So by every statistical measure, it's still an advantage to have a college education.
Simonelli says not knowing how to keep track of expenses makes the financial situation worse than it already is.
The one thing everybody in the United States definitely has in common is they all have to pay their own expenses. They all have to pay their own bills. And no place do we teach that to people, which is why we have seminars like this.
And let's not forget the one thing that continues to fuel the fire, that little plastic card in your wallet. And it hurts college graduates more than they know.
Credit cards are the easiest way to get into financial trouble, and it's the hardest financial trouble to get out of. So I think when people first get out of school, we can afford to be patient because we know their situation is going to get better over time. But with credit cards, they don't care.
Fortunately for Laurel Bennis, she is just a junior and has some confidence that her degree will actually mean something come next year.
I have another year. Hopefully the job market will pick up. It's promising knowing that the starting salary for my concentration is decent. So at least in that respect, I'll be kind of making a nice sum of money, hopefully, right off the bat when I graduate. So hopefully at least I'll have a job when I graduate to be able to pay back and chipping away.
But for those in her shoes, it's more like trying to take a chunk out of Mount Everest with a toothpick.
Student reporter Chris Aliano. This is Boston University's World of Ideas, and tonight we're featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Dolores Handy. Next up, Scott Flaherty introduces us to one recent grad struggling to find just the right job.
Please continue to hold. Your call will be answered in the order it was received.
Right now I'm sitting on my couch, waiting to get in touch with the unemployment office.
Jason Oberholzer is 25. He used to work in internet marketing at Bay State College in Boston.
This job was pretty much the epitome of a dead-end job, and I felt like I was doing less work than I was doing at an unpaid internship before, so I wasn't exactly learning any skills that could translate.
Before he worked at Bay State, Oberholzer received a degree in literature from Hamilton College, a liberal arts school in upstate New York.
I had the typical small liberal arts college experience, which prepared me, as I guess most small liberal arts schools do, to be able to communicate, read, and write.
In any of your comparative literature classes, did they go over how to navigate the unemployment system?
No, I never took a class on navigating the unemployment system.
Thank you for holding. All claims representatives are still busy. Please continue.
After an hour on hold, Oberholzer finally gets through, only to learn that he's not eligible yet, and would have to do the whole thing over again a few days later. Since then, Oberholzer has started collecting unemployment, but he only receives about 3/4 of what he made at his job. It's not really enough for him to live on, so he's been piecing together some extra income from writing and playing music, both of which he enjoys much more than his old job.
I spend most of my day working harder than I was when I was actually employed, doing a lot of different projects and applying for jobs. I mean, I barely even have time to apply for jobs now because I spend so much time on the projects that I have.
His writing projects grew out of a blog called I Love Charts that he started with a friend about a year ago. It's been more successful than he expected and opened the door for him to become a paid writer for a few different websites.
I've never been a writer. An example of taking advantage of a bizarre opportunity that's come my way and generally enjoying it.
His real passion, though, is music, and he's focusing on that as well.
Well, last year I composed a jazz mass for Jazz Combo and Choir with a friend of mine who had just gotten out of school for music, for composition, got his master's. And he sort of didn't have anything to do at that point, and I had a bit of free time. And so I pitched this idea to a church in Hartford, and it premiered last year. And through that, we got the opportunity to perform the Massachusetts debut this year with the Berkshire Concert Choir. And so that's going to be fun.
So things are looking up, and he's keeping busy. But Oberholzer is wondering whether his college days really prepared him for what came afterward.
I was frustrated when I first started applying to jobs because it was just so hard to get an interview. For any job I applied to, the degree didn't matter and the school didn't matter. What mattered is, had I ever done something like that before? And I expected to leave liberal arts college with a broad base of knowledge and to sort of have that be, I think naively so, I expected that to be generally respected.
Part of the problem, too, might be timing. Oberholzer graduated near the peak of the worst recession in generations. Here's Boston area career counselor, Gail Liebhaber.
You have lots of young, bright people graduating from college competing for the same jobs. And so you have to, while you're in college, think about internships. What's on your resume? What networking are you doing to prepare?
As for Oberholzer, he's trying to network now. He likes what he's doing at the moment, but he worries that he has no safety net.
Unless you have someone who's going to help you get in or experience, you're going into the ground level, often unpaid. And I don't know what they could have done to help that. There's no real training around that. Maybe they could have broadcast that more. I underestimated the amount of stress being unemployed would put on me. Because intellectually I was okay with it, and I took it as an opportunity, and I could spend time focusing on things I really wanted to focus on.
Still, Jason Oberholzer is glad he's no longer sending out internet marketing messages. And at 25, he knows he has plenty of time to figure out what to do with his life.
That story filed by student reporter Scott Flaherty. Up next, Kathleen Davies introduces us to students at the Berklee College of Music who've traveled a very long way to continue their education.
Wambora Mitaru has just completed her first semester at Berklee.
This music degree for me is a stepping stone so that I go into my master's, so that I'm able to teach people at the university level back home in Kenya. Not many people have the opportunity to come to this school, and so I want to learn what I can learn from here and take it back home. That's what sharing is all about.
Mitaru was one of hundreds of people who showed up to audition in Nairobi for a chance to study music in this country.
The day before the audition, I was sick. I was dying, I was swollen, I was half alive. But then on the day of the audition, I was a bit better. So I went for the audition and I sang in our national language. The song I sang, I had no accompanist. I sang a cappella. Then now the process of waiting was nerve-wracking.
Finally, she got a phone call from Berklee.
Have you checked your email? I said, I've been checking my email every single day and I've not seen it. And then I said, where are you calling from? He said, I'm calling from Berklee College of Music. And I wanted to tell you that you are an African scholar. Now, immediately he said that everything, we did not have a conversation after that because I was screaming, crying, wailing, shouting.
Studying at Berklee gives Mitaru an educational experience that would not be possible back home.
In my country, music is not something you jump into as a career as the first thing. It's not seen as a profession, it's seen as a hobby.
At Berklee, on the other hand, 80% of graduates end up working in the music industry. The Africa Scholars Program is the brainchild of college president Roger Brown. After college, he traveled to Kenya to work as a school teacher.
The scholarship we created is what we call a presidential scholarship, which is full tuition and room and board, which means that you really don't need to have a lot of family resources to make it here. You still have to get a visa, and there's still some hurdles to jump. But in terms of the cost of attending college, we take all that away. So for the musicians who get those scholarships, we're looking for the people who are the most talented of our entire pool of 6,000-plus applicants. And we're looking for people with demonstrated financial need, the intersection of financial need and enormous talent.
Berklee has 8 Africa Scholar students right now. Albino Beer of Mozambique is one of them.
I'm happy that they're offering that because it's very difficult for us as Africans to pay the living expenses here in Boston. The difference is huge. I did a lot of fundraising concerts back home, connections as well. I have people who are helping me right now to pay the rent because it's not easy to live here. Yeah, it's too expensive.
But accepting the scholarship also means leaving friends and family and trying to make sense of a completely different culture.
When I left home, I knew that I was going to a challenging place and I was ready for new experience. I felt that when I got here, I was like a baby, you know, where I should be ready to learn how to walk, how to ask this food, how to ask that. I didn't come with my concept that I'm gonna just live like this. I knew that I was going to a completely different culture, and the language, especially in my country, don't speak English. That was a real big struggle, but I'm finding my way to survive.
Despite the cultural challenge, Albino Bear has gained a stronger sense of identity. He composed the piece he's playing now. It's called Mozambican Dance. My hey, get to me
come. Coming to Boston made me realize that I am Mozambican. I have to keep my identity. And that's why I'm working on my music style, improving my identity. I spend most of my time trying to understand myself.
As he does that, Biera says he's always mindful of fellow musicians back home.
That's my big dream, to give back to the country and people who did not get a chance to come here. Because I feel that I was selected because I was lacking, not because I was better than the others. I know that there's beautiful musicians there. And to be able to give back and show them how is the process may open much doors for them to.
One of the things that makes you feel so good about supporting the program is that they're not thinking about, okay, how can I become a rock star?
Again, Berkeley President Roger Brown.
They're thinking about, how can I help the people I came from? They all acknowledge that there are many musicians who are probably more talented than they are who didn't get the chance. So they're humble, even though, believe me, they're pretty darn talented. But there's a humility and a generosity that just makes you happy to be able to support them.
It's a humility that comes with the opportunity to work with musicians from all over the world. Before coming to Berkeley, pianist Witness Matlow studied music at home in South Africa.
I've been in both programs, the program in South Africa and the program here at Berkeley. There's quite a lot that I'm learning here that I don't think I would have learned, if I was in South Africa. It's a great, opportunity, because you don't only sit in with, the best teachers. You also get to, meet other talented young musicians from all over the world.
And those musicians get to meet him. Berkeley's Roger Brown says another reason he created the scholarships is to bring the African musical traditions that have so much influence on Western music to students here.
Student reporter Kathleen Davies. This is WBUR. I'm Dolores Handy. You are listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. And while tonight's theme is the value of higher education, student reporter Tyler Murray found one person bucking the trend.
One person not sold on the value of a college degree is Gary Haynes. He's 26 years old, recently married, and lives with his wife in an apartment in Norwood. And he says he's doing just fine, thank you.
I'm a water operator. My responsibilities are protecting the public drinking water system and serving the community. I like the job. I like the responsibilities. My quality of life is very good. I'm a living proof that it's a possibility that you can be successful without going to college.
Haynes and his wife, Carrie Sanek, have already started looking for a house. Tonight, the newlyweds tag team a chicken and rice dinner while NASCAR blares in the background.
I don't know. I slaved away all day.
Once the table is set, it's not long before Haynes starts a scathing lecture on higher education.
It was almost cool for me not to go to college, because I knew there was still money to be made somewhere else other than going, and so far it's all worked out pretty good. As far as the money part goes, it's definitely way over the top on the price, no question about it. $200,000, you go out to Western Mass and buy a house with that money. That's a fact. And you could have a job, you could get a job out there and live. It's the truth. It's the truth. It's as true as it is you're going to find. And I probably wouldn't have my wife. I probably wouldn't.
That's very true.
It's the truth.
True. He probably would have been a womanizer.
Well, I'm sure I would have got the ladies, but...
It's really hard. You see in the news all these kids that went to college that have all these loans. They can't afford to live. They have to move home. I mean, there's a lot of people who went to school and they're doing nothing with it.
Carrie Sanek managed to avoid that fate. A degree from St. Anselm College helped her get a job in medicine.
I'm a registered nurse. I have a bachelor's. For me, it was totally worth it. I have a great career. I love it, and I couldn't have done it if I didn't go.
But college wasn't always smooth sailing, and Sanek graduated a semester late.
I was a great student in high school, but like when I went to college, it was like freedom. I just wanted to have fun. And I screwed around.
And that's all that I would do.
I screwed around, and I ended up not passing.
Haynes and Sanek haven't given much thought to children just yet. But when the time comes, will they want their kids to go to college?
Yeah, absolutely, I would. I guess it would depend on the person, who they are. I would encourage it.
Would I pressure it? No. I wouldn't be pressured. If it's a person that's going to just end up going to college, and then he's going to end up going back and working on his mother and father's farm, or something along those lines, it's totally not worth it, because you've benefited from nothing but 4 years of, you know, whatever.
Sounds like the couple might have some decisions to make in the future. And while a college education certainly has its benefits, it's not getting any easier to afford. College tuitions are expected to triple within the next 2 decades, so if there is a young scholar at home, start saving.
Student Tyler Murray filed that report. This is WBUR. I'm Dolores Handy with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. The theme of tonight's stories is the value of higher education. Our next three stories look at how the college experience can be a real life changer, beginning with a report from Amanda James on studying abroad.
Alex Zito came to Boston University in September of 2000. He came from San Diego, unsure of what to study, but he knew he wanted to do something big and make some money.
When I first came to BU, I thought I was going to do development economics, and I was going to study Japanese and be extremely employable.
But Zito hated the Boston weather. To get away from it, he decided to try study abroad.
There was ice on the ground by Halloween. I had to get out. I was like righteously indignant about it. I went to the international programs office, and a couple of the people that were working at the international programs office had been on the BU program in Niger. And they told me, don't just go somewhere that you could go at another time. Like, don't just go to Europe. It's boring. And it would take a lot of courage.
Zito was surprised to discover people with so little who still seemed to enjoy life more than he did, even when he was at home.
Niger really is poor. I spent a lot of days just kind of trying to process that, trying to digest the things that I saw around me. I mean, luckily, the program gives you a lot of time to do that. These more sheltered, packaged experiences where you can learn to play the talking drum.
College should not only prepare you for what your vocation in life is all about, but it should prepare you for life.
Boston University Dean of Students, Kenneth Elmore.
It should prepare you to be able to learn for the rest of your life. It should prepare you to be able to solve complex problems. It should prepare you to appreciate art and music. It should prepare you for your soul as much as it prepares you to work.
For Alex Zito, that is just what college did. He came back to Boston to finish his undergraduate degree, always building on what he had found in Africa.
There was nothing to read in people's own languages. That was shocking. So I saw, oh, here's a place where I fit in. Like, I can study literacy among these people in their own language because it makes perfect sense to me. And, like, I see this massive, glaring elephant-in-the-room style problem when nobody sees that it's an issue that literacy is not happening in people's own languages.
And that's just what Zito has done. He has made a career of bridging a gap he discovered between African and Western expression. As an African language professor at Boston University, Zito's research focuses on explaining African literature and thinking to the rest of the world. A year ago, Zito married a woman from Senegal. She still lives there. Zito would like to be with her, but he says he can do more for her and other Africans here in this country.
I wouldn't be able to do research like this anywhere else. One of the reasons I'm so committed to it is that I've never seen it anywhere else. You know, and it almost makes me angry. There was so much intellectual activity going on. Nobody was doing what I'm doing right now. So it's kind of like how I know I'm in the right spot, you know? It's like I found something that I'm so passionate about that it seems absurd to me that I'm the first one doing it.
It's a life nothing like what Alex Zito imagined before that first trip to Africa. But he has found his calling, a discovery that started with his effort to escape a Boston winter.
Student reporter Amanda James. Now, here's Mark Filippino with the story of two men separated by 20 years, and their very different experiences of coming out in college.
Good morning. Look at Kenny in those shades. I love them. Good morning, Ken. Kenny, don't forget your brother. Good morning, Miss Warner.
Chris Caron is a special education administrator at the Josiah Quincy School in Boston. Today, he's bringing in kids from the bus to their classrooms. As a 40-year-old, unmarried, gay man, Chris accepts that these may be the only kids he will ever have. But in college, that realization terrified him.
It really made me upset to think that I probably wouldn't have kids. Of course, the world is different now, but my attitude about it is different now, too. You know, my brother has a kid. I have a great nephew, and so I'm having a great time with him, so I'm not even sure if I want them. And now that I'm 40, it's getting close, you know, the time is ticking away.
Chris graduated from Northeastern in 1993. A time that he says was difficult for young gay men. In high school, he remembers the anxiety he felt when he first realized his mother knew his secret.
I came home from a trip, and my mother had cleaned my room. And I had some magazines in there, and I knew she found them. I remember going into the bathroom, actually, and taking a shower and crying to myself for probably 10 minutes, like realizing, like, this is who I am, and now I think people know about it, and I was very freaked out.
He and his mother didn't speak about the incident until he came out 5 years later. Once she knew, they both agreed it was best to keep the information from his divorced father, who was paying rent on Chris's apartment at the time. Throughout his first 2 years of college, Chris tried to suppress his attraction to men, thinking it was something that he could control.
When I came to Northeastern, I was still closeted. I was in a dorm and met a really good group of guys. We had a great time together, but I was still dating girls, or, you know, pretending to be interested in girls. Meanwhile, I'd actually been hooking up with one of the other guys on the floor, but we never talked about it. I was playing both sides at that point and still trying to date and pretend and live this facade.
His secretive life eventually led to emotional problems.
I thought about killing myself a couple of times. I thought about, like, would it be easier? It was just such a weight. You carry it around. It's like this big rock that you walk around with all the time. And once I finally got it off my back, it was very liberating. It was the best feeling ever.
That feeling of liberation didn't come until the end of his sophomore year, when Chris told his secret to a trusted fraternity brother.
We took a walk to the reflection pool. And I'm like, I have to talk to you, I have to tell you something. And it was very, like, very dramatic. And now it seems funny, but, you know, I took him there, and he's like, you're not going to tell me you're gay, are you? And I'm like, yeah. So it kind of he took a little bit of my thunder away, but it was because I was ready to do the big reveal. But he was very supportive.
Chris says the hardest part of being gay was finding other openly gay students to date. He says the atmosphere at Northeastern was not ready for openly gay couples, making healthy relationships difficult.
I didn't know any other gay people. You know, I mean, I was fooling around with boys, but we never talked about it. We didn't discuss what we were doing. We didn't say we were gay. And there was hardly any gay people on TV. In 1984, the AIDS crisis was kind of starting to come out, and there was lots of negative feelings about gay people. So there really wasn't anything like people have today. It was hard.
Chris is comfortable in his life now. He has a boyfriend and a job where people accept him for who he is. But he also feels his generation had it difficult. With no internet and a lack of celebrated gays in popular culture, there was no one for Chris to look up to.
I watch Glee now, and people make fun of me and whatever, but I watch, you know, boys kissing on TV, and it's a big deal. I never saw boys kiss. I didn't know that was allowed, you know, and it was just to see that on television, I feel so good for kids now who are coming out.
David Kilman is one of the kids that Chris would consider fortunate. Kilman is a junior at Boston University's College of Arts and Sciences and has been openly gay since he was 16. In high school, he was part of a gay straight alliance, which taught him how to meet adversity.
there's always the off argument on Facebook that someone will have with me about marriage issues. It's sort of having been trained in the very beginning to know, like, this is not a problem, and that if someone has a problem with it, then you should just address them about it and try to talk about it. But, you know, you never give your ground, you never feel bad about yourself, any of that sort of thing.
Life at home was welcoming, since Kilman had the luxury of his older brother coming out before him. With two gay children in his immediate family, he grew up being positively supported.
Before I came out, I was worried what my brothers and sisters would think. Not concerned that they would think badly of it, but just concerned, period. I mean, it's just one of those things that you know that nothing bad will happen, but you still don't want to do it. So when my brother came out, it was like, he'll totally understand, like, and we had this, like, really cool bond about it. We always talk about it.
Once away from home, Kilman never had trouble fitting in at college. In fact, being gay made him a unique figure to fellow classmates.
It was funny, in freshman year, I think a lot of people hadn't really experienced sort of open gayness in sort of the numbers as it was here. So a lot of people sort of thought it was novel and sort of cool and like, oh, I have a gay friend, fantastic.
Kilman had a few relationships at Boston University before dating his current boyfriend, Jim. He considers himself a source of inspiration for Jim, who wasn't as secure in his sexuality coming into college.
A lot of people where he came from, being gay was sort of a really difficult issue that they were dealing with. And so I think he saw me sort of having been down that road and passed a long time ago as being kind of awesome. And so I think he liked that a lot.
He's never felt uncomfortable in his surroundings. But from time to time, David Kilman still is cautious about who he tells about his boyfriend.
My one sort of weakness with being gay is telling people I have a boyfriend, because I don't know how they'll react. I'm in this computer science department at my school, and there's all sorts of people there from all around the world, Middle East, Far East, California, Ohio. Not all those places are maybe as accepting of gay people, so sometimes I have a little trepidation telling them about my personal life.
Even though 20 years and a range of experiences separate Chris Caron and David Kilman, they both agree coming out can be one of the most stressful things in a young gay man's life. They say people need to find their own sanctuary, whether it is college, family, or the support of friends. And through everything, they both feel fortunate to be supported the way they are now.
Student reporter Mark Filipino. Here's Vivian Ho with the story of one student's determination not to let a random attack ruin her college experience or her life.
To go anywhere, Annie Ropeek has to first snap together a collapsible metal cane.
Yeah, so here's my stairs. I have to go up. Usually I hold my cane in the right, in the left hand, because the railing is on the right.
Just 9 months ago, Ropey could run up and down stairs without a second thought. She was just like every other college student, worrying about nothing more than her final paper, her next test.
I was working at NPR in D.C. I was walking to work in August, and I was stabbed by a random crazy person in the street. One of the wounds, there were four, nicked my spine.
That nick changed everything. That nick meant Ropey could no longer move her left leg or feel sensation in her right. That nick meant hours of exhausting physical therapy, a semester spent home recovering. Everything she does now is a struggle.
Well, on day one, it was no movement. I noticed it, like, immediately, like, lying in the street. I was like, oh, can't move my left leg. Like, within first week, I think, I, like, had a kick. Basically, like, if you did the reflex hammer on your knee, it's that kind of kick.
And now Annie Ropeek is back at Boston University, finishing up the first semester of her new life.
Okay, I just got out of class on my second busiest day, which is Thursday. And it's about 3:30, I'm going to go to Kenmore and take the sea line back out to my apartment.
Her biggest challenge is figuring out how to get from here to there, in what has come to be known as America's walking city.
It's become not even like thinking about it anymore, because it's just like white noise practically. I mean, it's just like a constant consideration. Like, can I get from point A to point B? Do I need to take the T? Do I need to take a cab? And I just, you know, I have to like do a lot more planning. Like, things are not as automatic. In the past, I never would have thought twice about anything that I think about now.
Boston University is situated on the subway B line, which means Ropeek, who lives in an off-campus Brookline apartment just a few blocks from the C line, can't get directly home without changing trains. She could always walk, if she has the time and energy. It used to take Ropeek 2 or 3 minutes to get from the student union to her journalism classes, about a third of a mile away. It now takes her 10 minutes.
Went to a different kind of school, it might be different, but BU is such a walking campus that, like, I've had to change the way that I kind of approach college, because I used to just walk everywhere. Like, I would hardly ever take the T out to Alston. I would just walk everywhere. Like, I walked back from Harvard Square one time. Whatever, you know, it just wasn't even something I would think about.
To get back to her Brookline apartment, Ropeek is walking about a third of a mile from class to the subway station.
Are we still going here?
Yeah.
All right, so we're in. We're going to the elevator. I think of everything as a struggle. Just walking to the T in the morning is, like, probably one of the hardest things. Apartment is, like, a block and a half from the T stop, and then I'll take the T in to Kenmore and then take the bus to campus. And it's, like, a really easy commute, relatively speaking, but just, like, the walk to the T, just every morning when I do that, I always think, like, this... I hate doing this every day.
It took us about 45 minutes to get to Ropeek's apartment. Walking back took me 15 minutes.
This is weird, but I'm trying to, like, hold on to the memory of normal walking and just things that I used to be able to do, because I don't want to, like, realize one day that I've forgotten what that felt like to, like, be able to run or, like, just walk, you know, like, feel my leg or, like, feel temperature on my right leg, anything like that.
Are you resentful at all?
I sort of feel like this has, like, aged me prematurely a little bit. Like, I used to feel more just like a normal kind of, like, doe-eyed college student, and now there are certain things about, like, the way I see the world now that I notice are different from my friends, and I used to be the same and now they're different. It sort of took me a while to, like, realize that it was real life, and, like, this happened to me in, like, my life, and this is something that I have to deal with now forever in one way or another. I mean, you know, they say that I could make a full recovery, but there's not a lot of going back from it still, no matter what ends up happening.
Despite the constant struggle, Ropeek is doing her best to get back from it. This summer, she's going back to Washington for another internship at NPR.
Student reporter Vivian Ho. This is WBUR. I'm Dolores Handy, and you're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's theme is the value of higher education. Up next, student Jack Flagler has the story of one school with an unconventional yet increasingly popular scheduling alternative.
But when we actually put it into prose, it doesn't quite make sense to a reader that maybe is on a different wavelength, right? So this type of peer review is very valuable.
Professor Charles Daniels' English class at Bunker Hill Community College is like many other courses you'd find at a school in the Boston area. He lectures on citation methods while students half-listen and check Facebook. But you could forgive these students for not being completely attentive. It is, after all, 1:30 in the morning. In the hallways, there are no students rushing to class with book bags. There's just one security guard and a maintenance worker who pours herself a stale cup of coffee. Daniel, who's a professor of public health at Northeastern University during the day, says he has to change up his style a bit during the midnight class.
I try to move around plenty. There's really not much room for lectures in a midnight English course.
Daniel says he doesn't see much difference between the students at Northeastern and the students at Bunker Hill. He says he enjoys providing an alternative to increasingly expensive private universities.
You know, community colleges are a great deal educationally, and enrollment demand has increased, but space hasn't. So one of the ways to solve that is just to push the courses into the morning hours, into the evening hours, and this is a solution that Bunker Hill has been able to use effectively.
Daniel's students have different reasons for coming to class at midnight. Some have kids, some have daytime jobs, some are just like Ryan Noeth.
I'm like kind of a person that likes to get up late and likes to stay up late and stuff like that. So I was like, that actually doesn't sound like a bad idea, so that's why I'm doing it for the second semester, because it's a good class, it's a good teacher, and I'm fine with the time. I love it, actually.
Even though the students in the class have diverse backgrounds, they all want to continue on to earn bachelor's degrees after they leave Bunker Hill, and they are all worried about the cost. Noeth came to Boston from Germany, After serving coffee in the German army, he says he's shocked by how much Americans pay to go to school.
I kind of think it's criminal, almost. Other countries don't have that. Like in Germany, for example, there are some states that actually charge money for you to study, but it's at around 500 euros, and there are people complaining about that.
Yeah, this is what I looked at in...
Francois Menteau also came to Boston from a foreign country. He was in the process of earning a law degree when he left Haiti because he found the country too dangerous. In Boston, he had to start his education over, first by learning a new language.
I didn't get anyone to help me, and that's my biggest problem. Honestly, now I feel sorry about it because I am killing myself. I didn't get anyone to help me to tell me, okay, if you want to study law, okay, this is where you're supposed to go. Because my sister came down there a long time ago to work only. She learned English, but she didn't know anything about going to school, getting a major, or whatever.
Despite the lost time, Menteau finds the community college system worth it.
Northeastern costs about $40,000 a year. Bunker Hill just only $5,000 a year. The one thing students are supposed to look for, the better education. It is not exactly the school, it is what you learn.
Spanish.
Hey, listen, I like to get away. I'm kidding. I say one thing.
Ana Santos is a single mother with two children. She gave birth to her older daughter just after graduating from West Roxbury High School. Santos plans to apply to UMass Boston's nursing school after leaving Bunker Hill.
My kids come first, so what I dread the most is that one day I'm going to have to drop out of school. And if I'm finally doing something with my life, and because of the cost of living and children and school and gas and everything, just the cost of living, I'm just going to have to put my life aside.
Santos is far from alone in that decision. In the last 2 years, Bunker Hill has seen an 11% jump in enrollment. The midnight classes have grown from 2 courses to 8, and the number of students in those midnight courses has grown to 4 times its original size.
That was student reporter Jack Flagler. I'm Dolores Handy with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas as student reporters consider the value of higher education. In our final story, Aisha Siddiqui reflects on what it means to be the child of a mixed marriage.
Saturday afternoon, time to call the family. Mom's Filipino, Dad's Pakistani. My brother Ali and I grew up in this mixed marriage home, and trust me, I'm proud of my mixed heritage. But the reality is that most people don't identify as mixed, and I feel really out of place. My mom, her name, by the way, is Concordia Siddiqui, doesn't really see it that way, though.
Yeah, my color is normal, and yours and Ali's are normal.
I wish it were that easy. As much as I love my honey-toned skin, my in-between features, the sounds of my parents' different languages, it is difficult being mixed. Less than 3% of the American population identifies as two or more races. And so, ever since I was a little girl, I felt like the exotic other. I talked with Mariah. She's the 11-year-old daughter of my friend Aggie Goldsmith. Mariah has skin the color of cinnamon, long curly locks, and a smile that would make you melt. Her mother is Polish, and her father's African American.
A lot of people ask me if I was adopted, and sometimes I was like, no, and then I kind of got frustrated because it was being asked a lot. Well, it was just kind of annoying for me that everybody kept asking. And,
or is that your mom, right?
Yeah, because like my skin color is more closer to my dad's.
Don't get me wrong, curiosity can be flattering, in a way, but it can also be insulting. Here's my friend Aggie Goldsmith. She's Mariah's mom. Aggie's a tall, thin blonde with gentle blue eyes.
When they were little, I would go for a walk with my girls, and they would say, oh, are you a babysitter? Are you a Polish nanny? Just look at them and say, no, actually, they're my kids. Oh, how different. Oh.
How different. I got a lot of that growing up. Still do now. People are always scrutinizing. When Aggie, her husband Dennis, and their daughters go out with their family friend Cora, who's half Filipino, half Boston Irish, They attract a lot of curious looks.
Whenever we go out with Cora, people try, they don't know how to figure us out. Like, are you guys together? Your family? Yeah. I wonder how that goes. They probably think Cora with Dennis, they have those two kids, and Polish nanny.
We don't want to be dissected or figured out. Sometimes I get angry, but mostly I just feel sad. I decided to visit the new exhibit on race at the Boston Museum of Science, hoping it would offer some answers.
You go through and get your ticket scanned, and I'm now standing under arches that say, "Does where we come from tell us who we are?" It overlooks the icy Charles River, the gray of March, little seagulls. So let's go check out this race exhibit.
The exhibit challenges people to re-examine their idea of race, and, more importantly, how fluid and arbitrary it can be.
Oh, I've come across one part of the exhibit that has pictures of mixed people. Let me read one in particular. It looks like he has some Pacific Islander blood, wavy black hair, light brown eyes, and he writes, "What am I? I am exactly the same as every other person in 2500. And his ancestry apparently is Japanese, French, Chinese, Irish, Swedish, and Sioux. Whoa, that's a mix. So 2500, that's about 500 years from now. Are we all going to be mixed? That'd be really nice. I wouldn't feel so out of place. People would stop asking, oh, what are you? Because then everyone would end up giving, like, list and list and list.
Visiting the exhibit really brought home how people always push me into boxes I don't feel I belong in. I'm just mixed, frustrated and confused why everyone else wants to make me something exotic and intriguing. As I was leaving the exhibit, I felt really lonely.
I'm looking at these faces, hoping that I find something in common with them, that I'm going to see something in these faces that has some familiarity, some way I can connect. And there is a part of me that just really wants to belong to something, to have something to call my own, to identify with people, and it's hard.
I thought about it more, and the people I feel most comfortable with are those who are also mixed, but mixes of all different sorts. It turns out my friend's daughter, Mariah, feels the same way.
One of my best friends is mixed, yeah, too. Her mom is from Samoa, and her dad is American.
Look at that. She's best friends with all biracial kids. All of your best friends are biracial, right?
Yeah. My closest friends, yeah. Like, if I talk about Poland and if Caroline talks about Samoa, we kind of understand each other.
To be understood. That's what most of us want, isn't it? Just to have a sense of belonging. Each successive generation is more open to mixed marriages. The 2010 census shows the number of mixed children in this country has increased nearly 50% in the last decade. With the color of the country changing, you're bound to see more people like me and Mariah. The poet Gary Whitehead wrote, "We think that by naming we can understand, as if the tongue were more than a muscle. Leave your tongue to tasting and learn to appreciate the wholeness of every one of us who's mixed."
And you take me the way I am.
Student reporter Aisha Siddiqui.
If you were falling, then I would catch you. You need a light. I'd find a match.
That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Chris Aliano, who graduated today with a degree in broadcast journalism. He hopes to find work in sports communication at the college level. Scott Flaherty. Scott is a graduate student in magazine journalism. He's spending the summer as an editorial intern at the American Prospect in Washington, D.C. Kathleen Davies, who graduated today with a degree in broadcast journalism. She's staying at BU to pursue a master's degree in global development policy. Tyler Murray. Tyler just completed his junior year studying journalism. Amanda James, who graduated today with a degree in broadcast journalism. This summer, she's embarking on a 3-week road trip across the country on a grant she's received to film a documentary about underfunded communities in America. Mark Filipino. Mark graduated today with a degree in broadcast journalism. He's pursuing a career in radio reporting. Vivian Ho. Vivian graduated today with a degree in journalism. Jack Flagler, who also graduated today with a journalism degree. And Aisha Siddiqui. Aisha is a graduate student in public health and hopes to pursue a career as a health and science reporter. Thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who helped edit their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mark Deegan with help from Mike Toda and Michael Garth. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Congratulations to all of today's graduates, and thanks for joining us.